The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Another beautiful day here at Edstone as we rush, getting ready for Philadelphia Youth Camp starting tomorrow night. So we'll be, I'm sure we'll be talking over the next couple of weeks about family and youths and the God family vision and such. And that will be a nice study to get into. I don't know exactly what we'll be talking about every single day, but I know in the last couple of weeks, we have been talking about some pretty heavy subjects, and I guess if there's one good thing about that, we've avoided a lot of the U.S. Political scene. It's been nice to be away from that to some extent. I noticed one of President Trump's tweets this morning aimed at his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who was one of his most loyal allies in the Senate last year when he was campaigning. I know when Mr. Sessions came out in support of Trump, here he was a pretty conservative senator and really backed then candidate Trump, particularly his immigration policy. And now, I mean, he's really being singled out by the president. It's really just kind of stunning to imagine if you were Jeff Sessions waking up and seeing a tweet from the president who appointed you, from the president that you've loyally supported, saying that he's very weak on Hillary Clinton's crimes. Of course, it was President Trump who basically walked away from the Clinton scandals early on, and he even said it, I think, before he was inaugurated. But now he's bringing that up again, and now he's talking about Ukraine's efforts to sabotage the Trump campaign, which doesn't seem like it really is a good thing to bring up if he's trying to distance himself from being in so-called collusion with Vladimir Putin. In any event, it's just a big soap opera. And meanwhile, of course, nothing gets done. There were a couple of articles last week. I just never had time to get around to them. But one from the LA Times, Donald Trump set out to uproot Obama's legacy. So far, that's failed. And basically, there were quite a few pieces, by the way, last week about the first 6 months of Donald Trump's presidency. And quite a few of them that have talked about just how that there really hasn't been that much that's gotten done. There's been articles about the GOP Congress as well, the one about it being the most unproductive in, what was it, 150 or something years. So the deals are not getting done, at least not yet, in this this current administration. And the world, meanwhile, I mean, it continues to burn in so many places. Yesterday, we talked about just how quickly the pharmaceutical company Boots here in the UK, how it caved into pressure coming from the radical left and lowered its prices, or at least announced that it would take steps to lower the price of its abortion pill because of all of the pressure, the uproar, the outcry coming from female MPs here in the UK who just will not stand for a company like that, really just standing firm on possibly one of the lowest standards that you could stand firm on, and even that didn't hold. Well, today we read stories or headlines of Israel now caving in on the metal detector controversy, this pretext that the Palestinians have used, the Palestinian leadership has used, to stir up violence and hatred, to stir up murderers, in fact, terrorist attacks. The New York Times says this morning, after days of violent protests, bloodshed, and a diplomatic crisis with Jordan over the placement of metal detectors at the entrances to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem's Old City, the Israeli government said early Tuesday it would remove them. I mean, this became an international incident. And I told you last week about what the Jordanian parliament said, or how they reacted to that terrorist attack going back to July 14th. I mean, an attack on the Temple Mount, an attack where the attackers came out from the mosques. And they were armed. They were armed with guns. And they killed those two, those Druze Israeli police officers. And then the parliamentarians in Jordan, they get up and call those terrorists martyrs. And they say the serious crimes perpetrated by Israel will continue to justify igniting the fire of vengeance. I mean, it's Israel who's at fault here. King Abdullah, of course, was a little bit more diplomatic. But still, the reason this is important in this story is because Jordan, of course, they're the ones that oversee that Temple Mount complex. Israel just sort of hands it over to the Jordanian authorities, the Waqf, as we discussed last week with Brent Noctegal. But the New York Times says here, the turnabout came about after a day of intense discussions between leaders of Israel and Jordan, the custodian of the shrine, and with American mediation. It also occurred hours after the end of a standoff prompted by a confrontation at the Israeli embassy in Amman, Jordan. This was another incident. Again, largely, I'm sure, because of the Jordanian parliament and just what was being written in the news media. But quite a few people up in arms in Jordan protesting at the Israeli embassy. And then one attacker went after these Israeli officials at the embassy in Amman. And then the attacker was shot to death. And so that I guess there were two attackers, if I'm not mistaken, two Jordanians shot dead by the Israeli security guard there at the embassy. And then Jordan responded to that, saying that, you know, we may not let that security guard out of the country. So Israel was pressured to back off, and they did. They caved into the pressure, and the Palestinians win on this round. This is an excellent piece here, the National Review, Elliot Kaufman writing yesterday about the Palestinians using these metal detectors in order to manufacture violence. It says here, Elliot Kaufman says, PA and Jerusalem Mufti Sheikh Muhammad Hussein banned Muslim worshipers from passing through the metal detectors on the way to Al-Aqsa. He said the prayer of anyone entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque via the metal detectors is null and void. That's what the Mufti of Jerusalem said. You go through those metal detectors, your prayer's not going to count. Your prayer's going to be null and void. We've got to make our stand. We've got to stand up to Israel. They're attacking Al-Aqsa. That's been the storyline put out by the Palestinian leadership. Kaufman says, all of this sends an urgent and clear message to the Palestinian people. Riot. That's the message. And it came through loud and clear. And that's what they've been doing. It says, by pretending that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is under Israeli attack, Palestinian political and religious leaders have deliberately drummed up senseless violence. Senseless violence. And then listen to this. I thought this was a pretty amazing statement. How is it, after all, that murder on the Temple Mount does not defile the holy site, but metal detectors and cameras around its entrance do? I mean, the murderers came off the Temple Mount. And these two were glorified. I guess there were three of them. Glorified. And praised. Right there in the Jordanian parliament. Seen as martyrs. That in no way defiles that holy site. But the metal detectors, of course, that does defile the site. Kaufman concludes here saying, such demagoguery is nothing new, of course. Palestinian leaders have been making false claims of Jewish threats to the Al-Aqsa Mosque since 1929. I mean, this has been something they've been warning of for nearly a century. It says, for 88 years, it's been a call for war and a call for the murder of Jews. For 88 years, at least, the Palestinian people have been treated as pawns by a leadership more interested in protecting its own power than in helping them. He made the point, by the way, Kaufman did in his piece, that in one of the uprisings, you know, the protests, that was being really whipped up by the Palestinian Authority. In that very uprising, there were chants against Mahmoud Abbas because, in you know, his own people, so many of them see him as weak, and they prefer Hamas. They prefer Hamas, and so that then just makes the Palestinian Authority and Mahmoud Abbas that much more inclined to come out and to incite violence. So as I said yesterday or a couple of days ago, it's walking this fine line. Abbas knows he needs Israeli's security forces to just keep him in power there in the West Bank. And yet at the same time, anytime there's a violent flare-up, he's very, very quick to blame Israel. And these are the ones seen, as I said yesterday, as the moderate voices among the Palestinian people. Well, we know where it's leading. My father wrote in that 2006 article that I went through on Friday, I believe, that Zechariah's prophecy, that's Zechariah 14, implies that there will be an impasse over the Temple Mount, which the Palestinians resolve, quote-unquote, by taking East Jerusalem by force. We know that it's going to be by force because of what it says at the end of Zechariah 14 and verse 2. And so this really has been enlightening, just watching these last 2 weeks, even if it does die down a little bit now, and we don't even know if it will. I mean, this could be the beginning of another intifada. In any event, it really has, it's given us a view into what's coming. It's a preview of what's going to be happening. In the Jerusalem in Prophecy booklet, my father said, looking at the ongoing violence in Jerusalem today, the absolute inability of the involved parties to solve things by peaceful means, we can easily see how one half of Jerusalem shall be taken captive in the very near future. He says the present violence is an embryo that is about to grow into much greater violence. And it all has to happen. And the positive news, the good news, as I said yesterday, is that it's a prelude into the coming of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the return of Jesus Christ, which Zechariah 14 discusses it as well, really in the very next two verses. Jesus Christ setting foot on the Mount of Olives. And you can see in that same prophecy, Zechariah's prophecy, going back to chapter 1, where it says that God shall yet choose Jerusalem. Again, he's going to do it. I mean, he's chosen Jerusalem from the beginning. It's like we were discussing yesterday on this TV program we recorded. I mean, its very name means City of Peace, and it's mentioned all through the Bible. But my father brings out in his booklet that it's been far from a city of peace. It's been a city that's been right at the heart of so much violence and bloodshed, but that will soon change. God has chosen Jerusalem, and once Jesus Christ returns, he's going to establish God's headquarters. He's going to establish his headquarters at Jerusalem. And for 1,000 years, that city is going to be renewed and revitalized. It's going to be a peaceful city. It's going to be a happy city. It's going to be a city that serves as the headquarters for the entire earth. That's quite a vision. And certainly, we should be watching it, as I've been saying over the past week. Switching gears here for a moment, just to carry on with another subject that I've been spending a fair bit of time with over the last week or so. Just the breakdown of the family, the conspiracy against the family, in fact. There was a piece in the Telegraph today titled, "There's Never Been More Rape on Our Screens, But It's Now Illegal to Show Women Doing All the Housework." This pulls together a couple of stories that we've already touched on this program. Those tightening standards for advertising in the UK. I mean, they have to accommodate all types of families now, or that's the direction that we're heading in. I mean, they're going to crack down on those commercials that just show the traditional family. And then meanwhile, like this article brings out, on the programs themselves, on the television programs themselves, anything goes. Absolutely anything. It says here, there's something strange going on in the world of modern gender norms. Consider this. Britain's advertising authority has just decided that it is demeaning and unhealthy for us to be exposed to gender stereotyping in adverts. I mean, you can't show a woman as a housewife. That's a stereotype. You can't show the man as being averse to housework, or certainly not as being the leader of the home. Oh, no, we can't do that. In the same week, the article says, nearly 3 million Britons tuned in to watch the premiere of the new Game of Thrones season, a show in which about half of the main female characters have been raped. And of course, raped, I presume, on screen. On screen. So everyone sees that. 3 million Britons see that. And there's no problem there. I mean, that's wildly popular. That's winning awards. That's critically acclaimed. It says further on in the Telegraph piece, it's now illegal to show an ad that features a man trying and failing to undertake simple parental or household tasks. It's perfectly legal, however, to screen without comment a period drama like Versailles in which a woman is casually and brutally sodomized by her husband. So there's another one that hopefully you've never heard of. Versailles. You've got that. You've got the Game of Thrones. And it talks about how the defenders of all this filth, they say, well, I mean, it's true to the history. So we've got to put it out there on display for everyone to see. Well, I mean, how true are some of those adverts? I mean, just looking at the numbers, I mean, it's been a pretty much a society-wide breakdown of the family. But I know when I take my children to dance back and forth, I mean, I'll see families. I'll see fathers dropping off their children, mothers, and so on. I mean, there are still some left, traditional families with a husband and a wife and maybe two children. And so why can't you put up a commercial that has that as the norm? Well, as we know, there's an agenda behind this. There's an agenda behind it. And the leading voices, they're quite all right with these programs like Versailles and like the Game of Thrones. But they've got to get across their filthy message, even in the ads. That's what's coming. It says, finally, this movement suggests that advertisers have a new duty to sell not only their products, but a regulator-determined vision of the ideal society. The ideal society to those who are leading us and telling us this is the ideal. And it says here, whereas TV shows and films are exempt from such obligations, they get a free pass. And yet, as I said the other day with this other article, I mean, some of the things that these TV programs are showing would have been categorized as obscene 40, 50 years ago, illegal. Now it's just the reverse. That's legal. That's fine. The worse, the better. But you show just a normal family. You show normal behavior. And now that's coming to be illegal. It's totally upside down. It's crazy, really. We finished that video we taped yesterday, and after previewing it early this morning, my first thought was that, well, I hope we edited it, and I hope that I presented the message just so to where it's not held back, to where those that go through those programs before they go to air and carefully scrutinize everything that I say, everything that we produce to make sure that it can go on television. And that's right here in the UK, the same place where 3 million people are regularly tuning into Anything Goes on all these networks. But when it comes to ads or when it comes to religious programming or things of that nature, well then, I mean, there's large bodies, governing bodies, that have to carefully scrutinize every little point, every little thing that's said, to make sure that it meets compliance, to make sure that it can go to air. There's another story here from the States. The New York Daily News, you may have seen the news of the newest U.S. Navy aircraft or aircraft carrier. I think Donald Trump gave a speech on it or near it a few days ago. In any event, it's fully equipped with gender-neutral bathrooms. Did you know that? It says each sleeping quarter, this is from the New York Daily News, each sleeping quarter, what the Navy calls a berthing area, berthing with a B-E-R, a berthing area will have traditional porcelain bowels in the heads or bathrooms of the newly designed aircraft carrier, which can hold over 5,000 sailors. It says with universal bathrooms, switching the room assignments for each berth between the genders will be much easier. So it's gender-friendly. They've gotten rid of urinals so that it can be gender-neutral. That's now in the Navy. And I talked about the standards in U.S. military, the new gender neutrality standards. We touched on that yesterday. Here in the U.K., the Daily Telegraph had another piece on just the shocking transformation of our society because of these transgender rights that now seem to be right at the top of the to-do list for all of the politicians and the academics. It says here, Justine Greening is a libertine cross-dressing as a conservative. The equalities minister wants a shakeup of trans rights that would make it far easier to change one's gender. The Telegraph says this is not only a revolutionary thing to do, it is politically stupid. It was not in the Tory manifesto. Actual conservatives will hate it. The government's picking a fight with its own supporters, and for what? To impress its friends at dinner parties? So this article is basically just saying, look, this is a lose-lose situation politically. Why even get into it? But listen to this. And even that article I read previously, you know, it's a kind of a soft enunciation. The author even said, the one that talked about Game of Thrones and the ads and so on, whoever wrote it says, well, I'm a big fan of Game of Thrones. So, I mean, I do like it, and I did think that commercial was kind of stupid. But doesn't it seem a little bit off? I mean, isn't this kind of wrong? And that's about the strongest that you can get. Because even in that case, the author actually enjoys the Game of Thrones. And here's another one. All of this craziness going on, and the best argument you can come forward with is that, look, this is not going to score us points politically. We should avoid this. As opposed to, this is flat out bizarre and wrong on every level. It's ungodly. It destroys the family. Under Greening's proposal, adults will be able to switch the gender on their birth certificate without a doctor's diagnosis. While people who don't think they have a gender at all can alter it to read X. So you don't even need to get the diagnosis. You don't even need to get the doctor's go-ahead. You decide. Transgenderism will go from being a medical issue resolved privately in consultation with a doctor to a lifestyle choice endorsed by the state. See, you can decide. Whatever you say goes, and you have the full-throated endorsement of the state. That's where this is going. Really, that's where we are. It amounts to a cultural revolution, dreamt up and implemented without democratic endorsement and with precious little thought given to its effects. See, Joel Hilliker's written about this before at thetrumpet.com. I mean, our society is going through this dramatic transformation, and no one anywhere is giving any thought to the impact of this, the effects of all of this. The trans revolution, which has been amplified, notice this, it's been amplified by social media, has been almost universally accepted by our political elite. I mean, there hasn't been one among the political elite, really, to speak of, that's stood against it. I talked yesterday about, there at the end of the program, about standing against this movement, about being strong in the Lord, as it says in Ephesians 6. I mean, here this revolution is happening right before our eyes, and it's amplified by social media, by modern technology. But really, the most satanic thing about it all is that it's universally accepted by the political elite. It says here, it's no coincidence. Listen to this. How important is it for these political elites? How important is it for them to establish this, or to teach about this revolution among the young people? It says, it's no coincidence, I'm sure, that since 2014, the role of Minister for Equalities has been twinned with that of Secretary of State for Education. Shaping young minds makes the liberals' long-term goals easier to achieve. So they have their agenda. It's to totally destroy the traditional family. And to achieve this, they have to get at young minds. They have to teach them early on. It says, for instance, this is from the Telegraph, for instance, the Children and Social Work Act 2017 imposes relationships education on children from the beginning of primary school up. What constitutes relationships education is up to the education secretary to decide, which just happens to be Justine Greening, the same woman. The same woman mentioned at the start of this article, the equalities minister, wants to make it easier for individuals to change their gender. And so she's there too, heavily involved in teaching this, making sure it's in the educational system as well. It says here, as guidelines are updated, it's not unreasonable to infer and predict from her comments that tolerance of gender fluidity will be part of the package. That's part of the educational package, gender fluidity. It says the state is gathering power, building upon its success in legalizing gay marriage in 2013, one of those reforms that we were told was an end in and of itself, yet increasingly looks like a transitional demand. I mean, that was not the destination, same-sex marriage. That's so 2013. We're in 2017. It says we were assured that churches would be separated, even protected from this civil change, but both Justine Greening and Theresa May have said that while it's up to the Anglicans to decide, they would like to see same-sex weddings carried out by the vicars, and no doubt there are plenty of clergy itching to do it. The Church of England Synod voted this month to hold special services to welcome transgender people to the faith. See, it all sounds so good early on when the political elites just say, you know, look, this is just a civil change. You people in religion, you can do whatever you want. And here we are a few years later, and you can sense and feel the pressure. And of course, religion is caving into the pressure. You see it everywhere you look. In Israel with the metal detectors, with Boots, the pharmaceutical company. And now the Anglican Church, everyone must go along. Everyone must endorse it. Everyone must be on board with it. Someone sent me an article yesterday. It's a short one, an old one, from Herbert Armstrong from 1978. The conspiracy against the family. You talk about being way ahead of your time. It's a brilliant piece. Way ahead of his time. the conspiracy against the family, and Mr. Armstrong saying how few people realize in America and Britain and in other Western countries, how few people are even aware of this growing tragedy. The institutions of marriage and family, how they're under attack. There's a conspiracy against them. And he mentions in this article, like he does in The Missing Dimension in Sex, that the solid family structure is the foundation of a stable society. It's the foundation of a permanent society. He says, but today in the affluent countries of a conspiracy is developing which seeks to destroy marriage as an institution as well as the family. This is another decisive bit of evidence that the world's civilization is definitely in the end time, the end of the world as we know it. It's just one more piece of evidence that we're living in the last days. We're living in the last days. Paul said that that evil men and seducers would wax worse and worse. And Mr. Armstrong here is saying, look, this is obvious. It's obvious we're living like in the days of Noah. Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man. Mr. Armstrong, even before this article, this one's from 1978, but he was talking about the threat of the destruction of the family, how that it's a greater threat than a hydrogen bomb. Look at what it's doing to our society. Look at the revolution, the trans revolution of all things. It's amplified by social media. It's been universally accepted by the leaders in the United States and Britain. Well, he says here in this article from 1978, the threat is dual, unrealized by most. There is a widespread and aggressive conspiracy to destroy the institution of marriage. He says later, I feel strongly the need to talk to my plain truth readership of many millions about this major threat to civilization itself, and thus to your life and mine. It's time the facts were made known. Today, many psychologists are saying that the institution of marriage is doomed, on the way out. And there's a definite movement to bring it about. He says, the conspiracy consists of a two-pronged attack. Listen to this. He gives two areas where it's under attack. He says, number one, a well-organized movement to subtly influence college students to prefer alternatives to marriage. In other words, education. That's where it's coming under attack, in the educational system. And consider that with respect to what I just read to you from the Telegraph. So you have education, and then number two, he says, an attempt to influence the general public by newspaper and magazine articles, television programs, the lecture platform, the women's lib movement, and student or former student rebels of the new left. So the education, and then the media, or the political elites, the magazine articles, the television programs. Look at the restrictions or the strictures they put upon programs like ours or like ads. And then at the same time, for the actual programming, the evening program, the primetime programming, anything and everything goes. Mr. Armstrong says, how much of all this propaganda has been planted in the minds of the psychologists, professors, writers, publishers, women's lib crusaders, and others by trained communist propagandists can only be estimated. This is something we've talked about more recently at thetrumpet.com. These trained communist propagandists. And then finally, he says a little bit later, this is a war which is being vigorously and fanatically waged. Every subtle method is being employed to capture the minds of those of pre-marriage age. Every subtle method is being employed to go after the young people, to reach the young people. I was saying yesterday in an orientation lecture for our workers, as we get ready, to work with the teenagers in God's church here over the next couple of weeks, just how important it is for them to have a strong example, a good example, just how important it is for us as leaders, as ministers, as wives, as counselors, as activity heads, just how important it is for us to set the right example, to be ambassadors for Jesus Christ, like it says in 2 Corinthians 5:20, to stand firm against the devil and his influence. When you think about what so many of our young people, what so many of our teens are coming out of, I mean, even those that are growing up in homes where parents are doing their best to be very diligent and to teach them God's ways, still, look at this world. Look at what people see on television, even in just surfing the channels. Look at what pops up onto your screen on the computer. Think about what so many of our young people must hear or see when they go to school each day. It's frightening, really. We're just being bombarded. We've reached, as I said recently, we've reached saturation point. And that's why God's system of education is so crucial. That's why it's so important. It really is a vision of tomorrow. I read from a good news article yesterday. This is from May of 1980, and it's about the establishment of Ambassador College. And this article says here, when Ambassador College was founded, its name was not selected by accident. Those who are accepted have to really know why they want to go, and once they arrive, they are taught what it means to be an ambassador. Mr. Armstrong named it Ambassador College largely because of what Paul said there in 2 Corinthians 5. What does it mean to be an ambassador for God? This article says high standards are set so that high standards can be reached. Those standards touch upon all facets of student life, studies, finances, health, appearance, work, athletics, dating, and spiritual growth. And it goes on to say that if you're not willing to rise to those standards, you don't belong at Ambassador College. You don't deserve to be an ambassador. God raised up that college to train ambassadors for the church, for his work. And even as ideal as that was under the leadership and direction of Herbert Armstrong, look at what happened after he died in 1986. Ambassador College closed down just 7 or 8 years later. That pull coming from the world, as I said yesterday, it's so strong. And it takes the power of God to resist against it. It takes the power of God to stand firm in the Lord, to stand firm in the truth, and to set the example that this world needs to see. Jesus said that we are the light of this world. Jesus said of his disciples, "You are the light. A city that's set on a hill cannot be hid." He wants the church, he wants God's family to be visible, to be seen, not in a blinding sort of way, but he wants the example out there on display. He said in Matthew 5:15, "Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light unto all that are in the house." And then verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father, which is in heaven." That's the example that this world needs to see. That's the example that this church is God's family. It's the light of the world. God wants the world to see his family's good works. When you think about Jesus Christ coming to this earth, as he did 2,000 years ago, It says over in 1 Peter 2 that he left for us an example that we should follow in his steps. As I was telling the students and the graduates yesterday, how much was example, leading by example, right at the forefront of Christ's thinking every day of his physical life? As he knew, going in and going out, he couldn't trip up once. He couldn't sin once. He had to establish a perfect record. What an example he left for us. And that's the example God wants our children to see when they look at us. Now, we're not perfect. We're not perfect parents or ministers or counselors or workers. But we're here to follow in those steps. 1 John 4 talks about Jesus coming again in the flesh, living in our lives. It's so easy to just tell people how they ought to live and then carry on, you know, in a different way yourself. But God does expect his ambassadors to practice what they preach. And when you look at how bad the world is today, our young people certainly do need an example of righteous living. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send in a comment in response to the program or offer a suggestion of any kind, you can send an email to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, coming into the studio this afternoon, I told Sam that we'd probably have three or four shorter segments today, and I just concluded my first segment after 45 minutes, so I didn't actually hold to that plan, but I suppose it's good to go with the flow a little bit as well. So we only have time for maybe one more segment here, but I think I have enough here for 10 or 12 minutes on the royal family here in the UK. There's quite a lot of activity surrounding the royal family and the 20th anniversary of Princess Diana's death, which is coming up here in, I think a week or two. HBO is putting together a documentary on Princess Diana. They had a show on last night. I didn't actually see it, but it's referred to here in Melanie Phillips' piece from today. I think it was on ITV or Channel 4, I forget. In any event, lots of documentaries. The boys are speaking out, Prince William and Prince Harry, trying to remind people of Princess Diana's legacy. And I thought this clip that Sam found yesterday was kind of interesting. This is actually from the HBO documentary that's not yet out. But in this clip, you have Prince Harry talking about his mother.
One of her mottos to me was, you can be as naughty as you want, just don't get caught. She was one of the naughtiest parents. She would come and watch us play football and, you know, smuggle sweets into our socks. And I mean, like literally walking back from a football match and having sort of five packets of Starburst, and just the whole shirt was just bulging with sweets. And then I was sort of looking around, open the top box, throw it all in, lock it up.
That's Prince Harry talking about his naughty mother and how one of her mottos was that you can be as naughty as you want, just don't get caught. And, of course, I'm sure that this is seen as kind of a positive kind of trait, because over and again you hear these two talking about just how full of joy this woman was and how great of a mother she was and how that they could just tell that she loved them both so very, very much. And yet, as I covered a few weeks back on this program, when you look at the fruits of this family, sad to say, I mean, you look at the fruits, there's a lot of unhappiness. There was a lot of misery and suffering with respect to this program last night, the one on ITV here in the UK. Melanie Phillips brought out how that it was just a complete whitewash. I mean, glorifying Princess Diana, and then Prince Charles is hardly even mentioned. He's just erased, and he's still living. But the father, the husband, he's been erased from the story. I mean, neither one of them are perfect, but still. That program I gave 2-3 weeks ago when I was back in Edmond, I mentioned that 1981 statement that Mr. Armstrong made following the wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana. And Mr. Armstrong, in that sermon, just a couple months after the royal wedding, he questioned how long the marriage would even last because of the experiment. You get in there and you alter the marriage ceremony, you alter the vows, you make it a more modern marriage. And as Mr. Armstrong said, well, I wonder if it's even going to last. You can't experiment with family the way that man is experimenting with family life today and not pay for it with a lot of suffering and sorrow and heartache. And so the media, they're going to do their best to try to resurrect her memory and make everything seem like it was so wonderful and perfect. Was it? Melanie Phillips titled her piece, "We Don't Need the Cult of Diana Revived Again." We don't need that. It wasn't good in 1997. It's not going to be good in 2017. Phillips says Diana was the people's princess, in Tony Blair's immortal phrase, because she had reached out and touched, literally, the most needy and excluded. Everyone knew she herself had a background of emotional problems. She felt the people's pain and they felt hers. In other words, she was disturbed in a lot of ways. As her marriage to Prince Charles foundered, the image of herself that she cultivated as the victim of a cold, heartless royal family was thus widely internalized as unquestionably true. So when she died and the royal family was not publicly seen to be showing grief, an ugly public mood developed, and for a while the monarchy itself seemed in peril. I mean, here is a woman that very nearly brought the monarchy down. She very nearly brought down the British royal family in 1997. There are tapes of her early on in her marriage. This was brought out by The Telegraph just today, these controversial recordings that she had with a speech therapist. And in the course of these dealings, I guess, they're recorded. She also would open up and speak about her troubled marriage, about her family life. And there have been a lot of powerful organizations and groups that have tried to keep these tapes under wraps. But now, as the Telegraph brings out, now because, well, you have Prince William speaking about, talking about some of the things that went on the inside, never before seen footage. Prince Harry's opening up. I mean, if the boys are older now, if they're in their 20s and 30s, then maybe it's time for us to get a little insight into just how wretched the marriage and the family was. I mean, it makes for a good soap opera. The Telegraph says the tapes were never intended for public broadcast, and since the princess's death have been the subject of lengthy legal battles and accusations of huge betrayal. It says further on in the piece that in those tapes, Princess Diana described her wedding day as the worst day of her life. 750 million people tuned in to see that royal wedding. And all the smiles, all the pomp and the circumstance. You remember Mr. Armstrong saying this was Britain's last gasp of glory and splendor. I mean, no one can put on a royal wedding like the British. In these tapes, she says, that was the worst day of my life. And then she talked about her dating life with Prince Charles, how that they only met a few times, how that it was all or nothing. They'd be totally into each other, and then there'd be long gaps of nothing. Does that sound like a happy, traditional, Bible-based family life? Melanie Phillips, switching back to her piece, it says the reaction to her death thus signaled an enormous change in British society. See, Melanie Phillips, she's sharp enough to know that what happened there in 1997, the reaction in British society, it was disturbing. It signaled that there's an enormous change taking place in our society. She says, out went the stiff upper lip, in came emotional incontinence. Sentimentality was mistaken for genuine feeling. Victim culture and virtue signaling became the order of the day. In came also widespread credulity. In the face of emotive propaganda, Diana knew she had star quality as the media's most profitable milch cow, and she ruthlessly used it. She writes about how that she manipulated the media routinely. She used her celebrity power to get across her message that I'm the good one, I'm the victim. The bad ones are the husband, the other relatives, the family. It says this is not to deny the good causes she promoted, and it talks about some of those, but as Melanie Phillips brings out, what about Prince Charles? I mean, he's been part of a lot of good causes as well. It says Princes William and Harry themselves amply display an active social conscience, but the implication that this example came only from their mother is surely quite wrong and unfair. See, the father's erased out of the story. The film, it says, this is about the film from last night on ITV, the film presents Diana through a Vaseline lens. It makes no mention of the way she manipulated the media, nor the emotional disorders that preceded her marriage. And most unsettlingly, it makes no acknowledgement of Prince Charles by name at all. So he is completely erased from the story, and he's living. He's still with us today. She says, I guess Buckingham Palace approved of the film. You have Prince William and Prince Harry there in the video. Maybe the Queen has been lulled into a sense of security by the popularity of the younger royals, Phillips writes. And then she concludes with this, as the embodiment of the nation, however, the monarchy reflects back to the public attributes with which they identify and which they can admire. King George VI reflected stoicism in the Blitz. Queen Victoria reflected imperial power and family strength. If the monarchy now reflects dysfunctional neediness and narcissistic emotionalism, Will the nation really think itself well satisfied? If the British lion now yearns above all for someone to give it a cuddle, should anyone take comfort in that? What a difference when you compare it to King George VI or Queen Victoria. I mean, what she's describing here is what we've gone through in recent programs. I'll refer you again to my father's article, which we posted last week, I believe on Friday. I didn't bring it here with me today. The Fall of the British Royal Family, or The Decline, I forget how it's titled. In any event, make sure that you read that. I mean, that's already one of our top 10 articles for the year of 2017, The Fall of the British Royal Family. You can find that at thetrumpet.com, and you can understand the significance of it from a prophetic standpoint, and we've got quite a lot more that we're going to be producing on this very subject in the weeks ahead. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on yet another day of broadcasting here on kpcg.fm. You can email the show at td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.